Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. I hope that we've got the connection. I had a little problem here, but I'm going to presume we're on and everything is cool. Okay, today, what are some of the economic consequences of the war in Ukraine? Might be a little early to do some analysis and predictions, but some outlines I think are nonetheless apparent. What will the war bring in terms of economic change, not just in Russia, but also for Western Europe and the U.S. and the global economy itself? This thing has and will have significant economic repercussions, both short-term and longer-term. Well, what are some of those? What can we expect? Well, the first thing we saw in all three regions, Russia, Europe, U.S., was a collapse of financial asset market prices, stock markets, bond markets, so forth, right? Those plummeted, which typically are very volatile in these kinds of situations. The stock market, I think, fell like 40% in Russia, maybe 60, I'm not sure. Significant, big drop, right? Russia's markets are always more volatile than most in any event. But the declines also came sharply in Europe and in the U.S. I think the Dow Jones market in the U.S. fell like 800 points initially, but it recovered very quickly, as did Europe. Why the recovery? Well, it's because President Biden got on TV and he explained his new sanctions that he was levying against Russia because of the war. And it quickly became apparent that those sanctions were full of holes. And investors know that. And the stock market recovered very quickly the same day because of that reporting. And today, it's up over 700 points already. Positive, I think it was 850 points at one stage. Who knows how where it will end. But definitely, investors are saying, oh, well, you know, this isn't going to be too harsh economically on us. Especially when it comes to oil and gas and global commodities. As we will see, there were virtually no sanctions on those key sectors globally. And of course, that's Russia's main currency income earning sector, selling oil and gas and commodities. You know, the Russian economy, we all know, is very productive. Maybe not efficiently so, but a lot of output in oil and gas and commodities, especially metal commodities, metal ores, aluminum, so forth. That doesn't appear will decline much. You know, Russia is the second largest producer of crude oil, produces more crude oil than Saudi Arabia. And the U.S. produces more than Russia. Russia and the U.S. are one and two, actually U.S. one, Russia two, in global oil production. I'm not sure with natural gas, but probably Russia may even be first. I'm not sure. If the U.S. were to slap control sanctions on Russian oil, in other words, buying and selling its oil to the world, well, then, you know, those sanctions may have a dampening effect on U.S. oil sales, too. Certainly, it would raise the price of global oil if there were sanctions on Russian oil sales and gas. It would raise the price because it would reduce the global supply. And that price would be reflected in, Texas-produced oil. You know, West Texas Intermediate, they call it. And we already have significant inflation driven here in the U.S. by oil prices. Yeah, if you look at the 7%, 7.5%, I think it was, Consumer Price Index, latest, annual, about half of that, almost half of that, is due to oil price hikes as it bleeds into gasoline at the pump, home heating oil in the winter, right? Industry use of oil, just about everything. Oil is number one contributor to oil prices, to consumer inflation. So already it's significant, and it would drive up inflation significantly further. You're going to see price increases in oil anyway in the U.S., because speculators will use the war situation to buy up contracts for oil futures and hold them and wait for the price to rise and then flip them. So even without any real contraction of supply based on, a Russian oil sanctions that don't exist, you have inflation going on further in oil in any event. So, Biden is behind an eight ball on inflation right now, and most of that's oil, and opening up the U.S. strategic petroleum reserves has had no effect whatsoever on the price surge in oil here in the U.S. So, in long story short, the U.S. and Biden and the Europeans, of course, don't want to put sanctions on global oil. They're exempt. Yeah. And natural gas as well. Oh, but we hear, Biden is shutting down the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline in Europe between Russia and Germany. Well, they didn't shut down anything that hadn't opened up. It's been suspended. The certification, according to German Chancellor Stoltz, is on hold of the pipeline. But the pipeline hasn't produced anything. It's just suspended for now. And Germany and Europe gets most of its gas through Russian pipelines that go through Ukraine. Seven of them into Europe. Into Poland and Romania and places like that. And then from there into the West. And there are pipelines that go through Turkey. So, the natural gas from Russia is still flowing. Now, the price will rise, no doubt. If they had opened up the Nord Stream 2, it would have been a greater supply of gas and prices would have gone down. But now the prices are going to go up. And, of course, the Europeans are going to pay for that. And what you're going to see probably is the Europeans will be forced to reopen some of their old coal plants. Then you got pollution problems. Or even some of their nuclear power plants. Because now Russian gas will be more expensive and therefore less of it will be bought by Western Europe. Those are some of the consequences here for climate change, et cetera. Negative fallout from this event. But no sanctions. No sanctions on oil and natural gas. Now, the U.S. has been pushing Germany and Europe to abandon Russian gas. By the way, Russian natural gas accounts for over half of what Germany uses a natural gas. So you're cutting off over half of its natural gas flow. And you just can't pipe that much more through Ukraine and Turkey. So price is going to go way up. Inflation is going to go way up in natural gas prices, particularly in the winter here in Europe. Longer term, it's going to mean that the Germans in Europe are going to have to turn to alternative sources. You know, yeah, they'll try to install more alternative energy, you know, wind, solar, and so forth. But, you know, there's only so much you can do so quickly with that. And it's quicker to open up the old coal plants. And that's a consequence. And prices will rise nonetheless. So the point is, you know, the oil companies, global oil companies, particularly the U.S., you know, say, no, no, Joe Biden, no, no. We don't want sanctions on global oil. And they're not there. And there's no sanctions on natural gas, although the Nord Stream 2 has been suspended. The U.S. has, for some time now, a decade, has tried to get Germany and Europe not to buy Russian natural gas, but to buy U.S. natural gas. The oil companies who own the gas companies, natural gas companies, by the way, you know, fracking produces a lot of extra oil, has made the U.S. number one global oil crude producer, but also produces natural gas as a byproduct. And the oil companies own the big natural gas companies. And they own the big coal companies. And they own, used to own, the nuclear power companies. So, you know, you've got this consolidation, concentration of all energy sources. And the U.S. has been trying to sell natural gas to Europe. But to sell it to Europe, you got to put it on special ships. And you got to liquefy it. It's called LNG, liquefied natural gas. And you ship that to Germany. The U.S. has been proposing that to Germany for some time. But the problem is severalfold with that. One problem is the U.S. natural gas is far more expensive than Russian natural gas. I've heard five times as much. I don't know if that's accurate, but that's what I've read. A bigger problem is that you need special ports in Europe to accept the LNG, and they just don't exist. Germany would have to build two special ports. And you know, that takes 5 years to build those ports. So what happens in the meantime? Yeah, even if the U.S. wants Germany, and probably will eventually get Germany to do that, but it's not going to happen quickly. And even the increase in natural gas, of which is a greater demand, you know, coming from areas and countries like Qatar and Azerbaijan and places like that, it will take those countries a couple of years to expand their production facilities to provide the natural gas to Europe. So what does this mean for Germany and Europe? It means no alternative natural gas. It means they have to open up their coal plants again. It means they're going to have higher gas prices, significantly higher, once again, unless they open Nord Stream 2. Oh, but that's suspended. You know, Biden says it's been canceled. No, it hasn't been canceled. It's just been suspended by the Germans. When this is over, they'll have to open it up again. Okay, so that's one of the economic consequences. Oil, natural gas, price increases, inflation everywhere, globally, including the U.S. That's an immediate consequence of the war in Ukraine. And since oil plays such a big role in all prices for all manufactured goods and transport and so forth, what you're going to see is significantly more inflation coming short term. You know, the collapse of the financial asset markets, very volatile, that includes that occurs very short term, but that's recovered. Currencies, the currencies, you know, the ruble, the euro, the dollar, they took a dip here. they follow the markets to some extent, and but they're recovering as well. So those short-term economic effects in financial markets and currency markets are short-term, as I said. And they've recovered. They will be volatile. You know, they will continue to swing. But longer term is oil, natural gas, energy prices driving up general price increases chronically. We got chronic inflation, you know, in goods in particular. We had these supply chain problems that haven't gone away, and other domestic structural problems in the economy post-COVID that I've previously talked about. That's not going away. In other words, inflation's not going away. Now it's going to go up and not go away. And solutions of Biden to the inflation are no solutions. You know, opening the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, you know, oh, we're going to create more competition, you know, in these industries and companies in which we have near monopolies now, you know, like meat cutting and bakery products and so forth, you know, big companies, a few of them controlling the prices, gouging everybody now. Oh, Biden says he's going to create more competition. Well, he's going to spend $50 billion. Most of it will go to those big companies anyway. Subsidies. It's just a handout to monopolies. That's a solution to the escalating inflation here in the U.S. Okay, so the war ultimately in Ukraine is going to have a negative impact on inflation in the U.S., in Europe. Not so much energy price inflation in Russia, but certainly here. Okay, so that's one effect, one consequence. Inflation going to be more chronic and higher in all three sectors. I might include a fourth sector, of course, that's emerging markets. What's the economic consequences of emerging markets, you know? Okay, so another factor, another area of impact is going to be declining effectiveness of monetary policy and what's going to happen to interest rates. You know, they've been talking about raising the Fed, raising interest rates, which are drifting up anyway, starting in March, same thing in Europe. You know, and you raise interest rates two ways. One, you can just raise what's called the base rate, the policy rate, for short-term bonds and notes and bills. You can raise that. You can also stop pumping free money, QE, into the banks and the economy, and that will have an effect indirectly on interest rates as well. And the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, has indicated it's going to start raising interest rates in March. Previous discussion was, how many times and how fast, how large of an increase. We will see in March. But banks like Goldman Sachs have predicted there'll be 7 rate increases by the Fed this year. And some have been predicting even a 0.5% initial increase in March. Well, now the Ukraine war is going to have an effect on that scenario. First of all, inflation is going to be even higher. So, you know, logically, you would think the Fed would raise faster and more initially. But if you raise it too fast and too frequently, you're going to negatively impact the real economy. You're going to really slow down the real economy. And then you get what's called stagflation. In other words, you get rising prices that I've argued in the past the Fed raising rates aren't going to have much impact on. But it will have an impact on the real economy. Certain sectors, you know, like housing and autos and big ticket items where you got to borrow money. Small businesses borrow a lot of money to keep going. So, you know, the Fed, the central bank, both in Europe and the U.S., European Central Bank, have a real dilemma. And that is if they raise rates even faster now because inflation will be higher, they may slow down the economic recovery, which is still very tentative, you know, especially in Europe. In the U.S., it's turned around a little bit. In Europe, hardly at all. And now they're going to raise rates faster because inflation is higher. Well, they just may choke off the recovery. They just may precipitate a double-dip recession here by year-end or in 2023. Oh, that's a big risk. In other words, monetary policy is facing a real dilemma. Do they raise rates because inflation is higher? What will be the parallel impact on the real economy? Do they then not raise rates? Do they go slower and lower? They're behind an eight ball. Monetary policy has been neutralized. At the same time, it's pretty clear that fiscal policy, spending money on programs like they did during COVID to keep people from falling through the floor economically, that's dead. That's not happening. So what if the Fed rate increases slow down the economy and there's no fiscal stimulus in response? Where are we then? Oh, we're back in a recession. Now, you see the policy dilemma that they're facing? They, meaning U.S. and Western Europe. That's a consequence here of this fallout. That's an economic consequence that goes right back to the impact on supplies and prices of energy. That's a fallout of this war going on. Going to affect everybody. And then if you had sanctions on Russia, that would be even more of an impact. That's why they're excluding. They're excluding any sanctions in Russia or anywhere globally. Now, there are other holes in Biden's sanctions as well on Russia. Big holes, right? You know, they say, first of all, oh, they're going to freeze assets of rich Russian oligarchs in the U.S. and in the U.K. I doubt whether they'll do that much in Europe. Yeah. Okay. Well, so what? So 100 people in Russia? I mean, that has no economic effect at all, really. Not a problem. So we could forget that one. Oh, but they're going to freeze the assets of banks, Russian banks in the West. Well, some banks only. The Biden sanctions have big loopholes on sanctions on Russian banks. You know, the big bank, Cyberbank, doesn't appear to have any sanctions. They appear to be exempt. That may be incorrect, but, you know, they're talking about other banks. VTB Bank and so forth, second biggest in Russia, but Cyberbank, which, by the way, is heavily involved in transactions involving oil sales, Russian oil sales. Maybe that's why that's exempt. Now, and then they're going to freeze the assets in Western Europe of some of these banks, as well as the rich oligarchs. You know, well, Russia can do a tit for tat, you know. I mean, they can freeze the assets of Western Europeans in Russia, those who have invested heavily in Russian oil and commodities. Now, that cuts both ways. But freezing assets of individuals does not have any effect. That's just for public consumption. But, you know, the assets of Putin aren't frozen. He's not in that list of Russian oligarchs. Why is he exempt? Well, they have no answer to that. You know, maybe they don't want Biden's son to be his assets frozen either. You know, they don't want to go that tit for tat there. Okay, so, you know, personal sanctions, irrelevant. What about other Russian sanctions? You know, oil and gas, first of all, is exempt, to summarize. Some of the Russian banks are exempt, all right? Some of the rich Russians are exempt. Some aren't, some are. What about the announcement yesterday that Russian aluminum is exempt? Oh, Biden met with American Aluminum Trade Association and the auto companies and the Boeing and the canning industry, all that said, hey, we import a lot of raw Russian aluminum here. You got to exempt us. And Biden did. And, you know, the rest of them are going to start lining up, too, for other key Russian commodities, metals in particular. They're going to line up and want exemptions, too. And as Biden exempts these from the sanctions, the Europeans are going to do the same thing. So we got big holes here in Russian commodity sales, in Russian oil and gas sales, and partially in Russian banking. Now, there's another area of sanctions. If Biden really wanted to do it, he could have. And that's denying Russian access to the SWIFT. That's an acronym, SWIFT. I think it's Society for World Something Financial Transactions. What is SWIFT? SWIFT is a major vehicle of U.S. financial imperialism. SWIFT is the system in which the U.S. can see all the transactions going on in the world and who's violating sanctions. Yeah, it's a window into who is violating the sanctions. The U.S. banks are at the core of SWIFT, and they cooperate with U.S. government when it comes to, well, who's doing what? Who's violating what? SWIFT is key for that. You know, it's right up there, importance for financial imperialism with the IMF, International Monetary Fund, you know, the World Bank, and the U.S. dollar as the global reserve and trading currency, especially oil, almost all oil. I think 85% of all oil sales has to be done in dollars, you see. So if the dollars, your dollar, your currency is the global currency, you know, it gives you tremendous economic power. You add to that the World Bank, the IMF, all these trade treaties that exist, and the SWIFT international payment system. Well, SWIFT is not part of the sanctions. Yeah, been specifically excluded. By the way, SWIFT is headquartered in Belgium, in Europe. So you'd have to get the Europeans to agree to that. And they're not. And they won't. So forget imposing SWIFT. Now, by the way, those who want, you know, the war factions in the West here, that we'll talk about later, who want more aggressive action by the U.S. economically in terms of sanctions, but also militarily, as we'll talk about, they're pushing. Yeah, you need to deny Russian access to SWIFT. And Ukrainian premier, prime minister, president Zelensky really raising the demand. Why aren't you denying Russia access to SWIFT? Okay, so that's exempt. To sum up, SWIFT is exempt, oil and gas is exempt, Russian crude or our basic metal commodities are exempt. Some of the banks are exempt. Well, what kind of sanctions are those? Well, the U.S. knows, Biden knows, that he's going to shoot the U.S. economy in the foot if he implements severe sanctions. So a lot of this talk about, oh, you know, these are going to be really severe and they're really going to put a bite on Russia, I think is nonsense. And the markets, investors think is nonsense too, because when they were described, you know, investors said, oh, took a deep breath and said, well, that's good. Let's go back and boost the stock market again, and which is exactly what they've done. Okay. Well, other sanctions are targeting goods flows, exports, imports of goods, right? Denying Russian access to purchase, in other words, import certain goods from Western Europe and elsewhere. The U.S. and Russia does very little goods trade, by the way. So the U.S. can't have that much of an effect if it sanctions Russian imports and exports to and from the United States. But Russia has a big export and import flow of goods with Western Europe. Okay, so the Europeans will take the brunt, not only of energy price increases, but they'll take the brunt of loss of markets in Russia, selling to Russia, and the brunt of Russia selling goods other than energy, to Western Europe. The Europeans will. The U.S. is trying to cut Russia off from access to technology, in other words. So, you know, semiconductor chips and so forth, software, hardware necessary for, you know, military and so forth, are all on the list of sanctions. In other words, can't be sold to Russia. But it's going to take a while to ramp all that up. This Ukraine war is going to be over relatively quickly. So it's a long-run punishment of Russia. Now, you know, it's also part of U.S. financial imperialism practices that when you want to put pressure on a country, you know, that's doesn't want to play ball with the U.S. empire, economic empire, wants to go its own way, whatever, you know, be it Venezuela or Iran or whatever, Cuba, then, you know, financial imperialism, you know, its main weapon is to destroy the currency of the target country. How do you do that? Well, you deny that country access to dollars, which are needed to buy a lot of the goods that these countries need globally from other countries. You know, all other countries are far more dependent on trade, buying and selling. And if you dry up the access of these countries to obtain dollars by selling their products, exports, getting paid in dollars, so that they can then use those dollars from the sale of their exports to buy much-needed imports, usually food and medical supplies and so forth, right? If you prevent them from accumulating dollars, well, then you're putting a squeeze on them. And if the supply of dollars into your their economy falls because you're squeezing them, preventing them obtaining dollars by sanctions on their exports, you know, the supply of dollars, the supply declines, well, then the cost of dollars in those countries will rise. That's just supply and demand, right? And if the cost of those dollars rise, then their own domestic currency falls because currencies in the world exchange in relationship to the dollar, inversely mostly, right? If the dollar goes up, their currencies depreciate. Dollars goes down, their currencies appreciate. Well, if they cut off dollars to these countries, their currencies will collapse, which means to the extent that they can buy goods around the world with their own currency, the currency is depreciated and they have to use more currency to buy the goods. By the way, a depreciating currency, another country does not want to accept them because it's depreciating. So depreciating currency, can't sell this, can't buy what you need. You don't have enough dollars. You got to add more of your own currency. You increase the supply of your own currency and you depreciate the value of it even further. So the currency collapses. Your domestic currency collapses. We saw this very clearly in Venezuela. The U.S. deprived Venezuela in various ways of dollars, sucked the dollars out of the system, out of their economy. Venezuela had no choice but to increase its own domestic currency supply, and that depreciated it further, and the bolivar became almost worthless. Well, that's, you know, one of the tactics of financial imperialism. Dollar is the global trading currency, deprive a country of the dollars, and therefore cause its domestic currency to depreciate. And if it can't buy needed things for its populace, you know, food or medical supplies, that generates social protests, you see, destabilizes the country politically. Well, is the U.S. going to be able to deprive Russia of dollars? Will it matter? Well, Russia knew from past experience dependency on the dollar made them very vulnerable. And in the last decade, at least, Russia has accumulated a war chest of currencies, including dollars, that it's sitting on, just in case. How much? Well, at least $300 billion in other kinds of currencies, so we can trade with the rest of the world in their currency rather than dollars. And I think several hundred billion of dollars. They're sitting on a pot. I've read as much as $680 billion cash hoard that it can subsidize industries, some of its industries and companies, that might need dollars or other currencies to continue trading with the rest of the world and not be dependent on the U.S. dollar. And probably also used to make whole some of the oligarchs who may be losing money too with their assets frozen. So they're sitting on a good hoard here, banking of cash over recent years to minimize the impact. Well, the ruble probably will fall some, but it's not going to collapse. Russia knew this was coming, you see. So this financial imperialism tactic to cut off, to sanction and cut off export sales of Russia, and therefore the ability to earn foreign currencies and dollars, probably won't have that much effect on Russia financially. Yeah, it will ultimately squeeze them out of some asset, technology and other goods purchases. But, you know, there's this relationship now between Russia and China. And China is not exactly a technology lightweight. Russia will simply turn to China and purchase the technologies that it needs. And China, of course, turns to Russia and absorbs more of any gas and oil that Russia is not able to sell on the global market. One of the fallouts, by the way, of the war economically is that the yuan, the Chinese yuan, appears to be playing an increasing role as a currency haven. In other words, when there's instability, countries buy a currency that's stable or rising in value. And that seems to be the case now with the Chinese yuan, or yuan, whatever you want to pronounce it, right? That's a fallout. The fallout, too, another fallout is it's clear the U.S. is trying to now seriously negotiate with Iran to ensure its oil supplies and lift the sanctions on Iran. That's a positive fallout for Iran from the war. Chinese currency as the haven currency is another fallout. Russia will turn more to China. And by the way, any of the exports that seem to be sanctioned, Russian exports to Europe, you know, there's a workaround through China for Russia. It could simply, instead of buying these exports with rubles, it can try, which might be sanctioned, it can exchange the rubles for yuan, Chinese yuan, and buy it through China. So, you know, it's a global economy, and it's integrated now financially and in goods flows and in resources. And that means there's a lot of workarounds to these sanctions. Sanctions don't work very well, and they won't. And if they don't, then they're not going to have a negative effect on the Russian economy, at least not to the extent that is being predicted by Biden. In Europe, as I said, what's the impact of the war on Europe? We said, obviously, you got rising inflation. It's going to be a consequence. You got the dilemma of monetary policy now. You got the possibility that you're going to have a slowdown in the recovery, which is all relatively more weak in Europe. That's a consequence. Slowdown recovery means more unemployment. Another consequence for Europe is that the U.S. is probably going to put more pressure on Europe to shoulder a bigger burden of the increase in defense and war spending. You know, Trump already strong-armed them to get them to pay a bigger share. The U.S. is going to do the same, I'm sure. Biden is going to do the same. He just won't do it, you know, as in bullying fashion that Trump did. Will the Europeans go along with it? I don't know. We'll see. Certainly the East Europeans, Poland, the Baltics, want more war goods, right? They're within NATO rattling the sword the most. And they want the U.S. to move more goods and materials and men and divisions to their countries. Well, that means a nice inflow of money for them. You know, they'll benefit and by the war in Ukraine, because they'll get the U.S. to send more goods and services there. But the U.S., you know, is going to have to spend more. And they will ask on more goods, and they're going to have to ask Europe to do the same. How much more will the U.S. spend? Well, we're already spending $78 billion in 1 year this year on the Pentagon. And when you add all the other little slush funds that have to do with defense, it's over $1 trillion a year. That's now going to go up even more so. And so will the budget deficit go up even more so as the economy may slow because of inflation. So it's a double whammy, you see. More defense spending? How much more? I think by next year you could look at tens of billions of dollars added to the $778 billion, which means tens of billions of dollars more deficits and debt. And as interest rates go up, the cost of servicing that extra debt will also go up. It means if you're spending more on defense and paying investors for borrowing because of the deficit and the debt, there's going to be more pressure to cut social programs, spending, austerity. So consequence, longer term, could be a shift to more austerity and social spending faster than otherwise. That was coming anyway. You know, after the spending of the COVID thing here, which is over, now they're going to try to figure ways as the economy recovers in the U.S. to take some of that money back. That's exactly what Obama did. You know, I've said this before. We're saying again, in 2009, Obama spends, what, $870-some billion in his stimulus program in 2009. 2 years later, he comes back and agrees with the Republicans to take out $1.5 trillion. So he gives with one hand, takes back twice with the other. That's austerity. And then he extends the Bush tax cuts for another $5 trillion in 2013. You can expect that to happen again with, you know, in the wake of the spending on COVID stimulus here. Yeah, they gave $2-3 trillion into the economy, small businesses and workers and so forth, right? But they're going to take it back. But now when they have bigger deficits and debt because of more defense spending, they're going to take back more and maybe sooner. That's a longer-term fallout of this. The U.S. will increase. The military-industrial complex will enjoy really profitable, even more profitable times here going forward because of the war in Ukraine. And the U.S. will ask Europe to spend even a greater share of its own. And that will mean austerity in Europe, too. They'll have to start chipping away at some of their very generous social programs. See, Europe has enjoyed the U.S. paying for its defense bill mostly here for decades now, since the post-war period. And they were able to provide better social spending programs for their people. But if that's coming to an end, they got to spend more on war and defense. That means they'll spend less on social programs. The welfare state, the social welfare state, you know, it's going to fracture even further in Europe as a result of this. Long term, of course, this is not going to happen overnight. Yeah, but Europe is probably wondering, you know, Biden, you know, is at least talking to us here. You know, it's the old relationship, but you know, the U.S. looks pretty unstable politically. You know, if not Trump, then someone like him could come back in a couple years, and then, you know, we're right back where we are. The U.S. beating on us. We better go our own way. I know a lot of talk about in Europe until this Ukraine war about creating their own defense system, military defense industries and system. Well, that's put to bed, of course, because of the Ukraine thing right now, and they got this show of unity going on, but it's a lot of it is a show. Europe does not want to get embroiled in a European war on its doorstep. But, you know, there are forces in the U.S. and in Eastern Europe who are pushing for more confrontation with Russia in Ukraine. I've been watching CNN in particular, you know, here, and it's amazing. All they got on are these former generals and CIA analysts, you know, and government officials and so forth, and they're all singing a certain tune here. And among the, you know, there are phrases, stanzas within that song that are very worrisome. You know, I've seen several generals come on already and say, we've got to send NATO into Ukraine to help the Ukrainians and Zelensky, you know, in their heroic fight. Yeah. And that was send convoys. Yeah, one general said, let's send a convoy to Kyiv. to rescue. Another one said, oh, we need to send NATO planes to provide an umbrella over Kyiv, the city, to help them. So what do you think Russia would do if NATO directly comes in on the side of Ukraine? Oh, that's a worrisome thing. Yeah. And then you see politicians, U.S. politicians, and the media that is beating the drum that, Putin is unstable. His isolation here during COVID, he's unstable. He's acting like Saddam. Yeah, they're trying to vilify him as quote, the new Saddam that we got to get rid of. And even more worrisome than that, they're beginning to say that Europe and NATO and U.S. need to take more direct action because Putin isn't going to stop at the Ukraine. Putin has plans, they never say how, to keep going into Poland and Eastern Europe and the Baltics. Yeah, that's his bigger plan, and we better stop him. In other words, this is all arguments for getting, the Warhawk faction, for expanding the war, getting NATO to rescue Zelensky in the Ukraine. Yeah, that's what it's all about. That war drumbeat is rising in the West. So far, it's not policy, but that's what's going on, and that's really worrisome. This guy is Saddam. We need to go in and help Zelensky. We need to provide air cover. We need to send convoys, Stinger missiles, etc. If you go back, how did this thing start? It all started years ago. In 1999, when Bill Clinton was barely holding on because he couldn't get keep his zipper closed, right? And they were trying to impeach him. He did whatever the war faction wanted. He went and bombed the hell out of Serbia. Oh, wait a minute. NATO is not an offensive structure. It's strictly defensive. Well, go explain that to the Serbians and the Yugoslavs or to the Libyans, that NATO is never offensive. Yeah. This thing began back when Clinton pushed and agreed to bring NATO east. I think, it was Poland and Czech Republic were the first, And then George W. Bush soon after pushes even further NATO even further east. I think that's when, Romania and some Bulgaria and others were added on Bush's terms, And then, John McCain gets the Georgia president, Saakashvili, I think his name was, to invade Ossetia, South Ossetia, a province in Russia. And that backfires, of course. The Russians throw him back and take some of his property, neutralize Georgia. Georgia wanted to join NATO. Now, and the U.S. still says it's going to add Georgia to NATO. And then the U.S. gets behind engineering this coup in 2014 in the Ukraine. Deputy Secretary of State Victoria Nuland behind that one. Clearly a meddling in Ukraine. Uses the shock troops of the Ukrainian Nazis to attack the parliament and drive the pro-Russian president out. And put in, a soft on Nazism Parliament, 2014, and then that group immediately attacks the Russian provinces, speaking provinces in the east, which brings Russia in 2014 and 16 to protect those provinces. And then you have the standoff in Donetsk and Luhansk. Well, that was precipitated because the Nazi led battalions there in the Ukraine National Guard went after the people in the east. And then we added the Baltics to NATO. Well, gee, if you were Russia and you know you saw what went on in Georgia and you saw NATO moving east, and then the U.S. began some big moves in Ukraine recently. Go back to November. You know, the U.S., by the way, has always said its intention and NATO's intention was to bring Ukraine into NATO. They said, you know, that goes back to, I think, 2016 or 17. And it's part of the Ukrainian constitution that it will join NATO, you know, with this coup government. And then in November, the U.S. signs the deal with Zelensky in the Ukraine, right, that says they will accept Ukraine into all the European institutions. Does that include NATO? I'd like to see that document. And then the U.S. sends in advisors to work with the Ukrainian military, and they have joint military operations. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, Zelensky says, well, we're going to take back Crimea. And, you know, you should also agree, NATO, to allow us to restore our nuclear weapons capability. Well, that was the last straw, you see. November. And that's when Russia begins building up its forces and plans to stop this thing. And that's where we are and how we got here. It goes back to one word, NATO. Pushing east. You know, what would you think the U.S. would do if the old Soviet Union signed an agreement with Mexico to join the Warsaw Pact? Do you think the U.S. would invade Mexico? You're damn right they would in the New York Minute. Put this thing in some context of what's going on. Yeah, this is, you know, the background to this war. And, of course, we're talking about the economic effects. For the U.S. will be more inflation, will be a slower economic recovery, will be instability in its monetary policy. Sanctions won't have that much of an effect on anything, I don't think. The U.S. wants to sell more natural gas to Europe. That's behind it all. And we will see more economic instability and even political in the fallout as this thing continues in Ukraine. All right, I'm out of here.